This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Word for Word. Thank you for joining us. Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson are with you today.
In July 2008, the Australian government announced the formation of the Organ and Tissue Authority, a new national agency costing $151 million, aimed at establishing a world's best practice approach to organ and tissue donation for transplantation.
Right now, there are approximately 1,700 Australians waiting for a life-saving or life-improving organ transplant. In 2009, 247 people donated organs to 799 Australians. In 2010, the first full year of the government's new authority, a record 309 deceased Australians donated their organs and tissues for transplant. Their extraordinary generosity saved or improved the lives of 931 people. Now, if only all government authorities could be so successful.
Sadly, the waiting list for organ and tissue remains long, and those on it continue to suffer each day. Tragically, at least two people will die each week while waiting. If you think, like I do, that the greatest thing that you could do in this world as you leave it is to donate your organs to someone in need, then think again.
Why? Because it's not your decision to make. No matter how good your intentions are to donate your organs, the decision is left to your family who, often distraught and full of grief and loss at your passing, fail to comply with your wishes. Why? Because you never told them.
Joining us word for word is Violet Marion, who is an organ donor coordinator for Donate Life Victoria. And Kate Driscoll will be catching up with us on the phone. She is a liver transplant recipient. Welcome, Violet.
Thank you.
Now, I really want to know more and more about this. I'd love to know, what is the Australian Organ Donor Register for a start?
The Australian Organ Donor Register, Sue, is a register that operates to capture the wishes of Australians who wish to register their wish regarding organ donation. So either, as most Australians who are on the register, they've registered a yes, that they are willing to be organ donors when they die. However, the register also can capture people's wishes if they do not wish to donate.
And this is different now. So if I've registered prior to 2008, has that now gone into an abyss?
No. So there's been different phases. So in some states, registration for organ donation used to be on when you got your licence or renewed your licence, and then there was a national register. So all of these different state registries were captured on the national register. And then in 2005, there was a reform of that. So it went from being a registration of intent for organ donation to a consent registration. So anyone who is on there, and there are over 5 million Australians currently on the organ donor register, have registered their consent to be organ donors.
Why isn't it compulsory? An opt out instead of an opt in.
Okay, it's look. A lot of people ask that question, Dean, and it's there's no simple answer. And you know, we believe, looking internationally at different countries, that the opt out is not necessarily the magic bullet that's going, or silver bullet that'll, you know, fix it. In any case, even countries like Spain that have a high per capita donation rate, and they have a form of opt-out, but the families are always consulted, and families can actually override that. So it's not a strict opt-out. And we believe that the way to improve organ donation rates in this country is to engage the community, raise awareness, get people talking about it and sharing.
And I guess it leaves people with a better feeling anyway, yeah, if they've opted in rather than... Yeah.
True. And I mean, culturally, you know, Australians, this is, you know, just my thoughts. I think we're a fairly independent people that don't like to be told.
Don't tell me what to do.
So I think it's important that we make that decision. And look, families, I'll just say that overwhelmingly Australians are supportive of organ and tissue donation. But as Dean, you mentioned, it's situations where families don't know what their loved one wanted that they'll err on the side of caution and say no. So the key is tell your family.
Now, according to the latest statistics, 40% of Australians do not know the donation wishes of their loved ones. That's extraordinary.
It is, actually. We don't know why that is, but we suspect that no one really likes to talk about their own mortality or their death, and there never seems to be a right time to talk about it. But what we're encouraging people to do is just to have that brief conversation.
Well, perhaps it relates to this, is that Australia has also one of the lowest donation rates in the developed world, even though 98% of Australians agree that organ and tissue donation has the potential to save and improve lives.
That's right.
So it doesn't quite match up.
No.
Maybe it's that discussion point that really we don't talk about sex and death.
Possibly. Or is it, and I'm just thinking out loud here, is it part of the disconnect of our healthcare workers to engage families at that time of grief? Are they not doing their job right? It's a tough job.
It is a tough job in many ways. But I think no, the answer is no. I think we have performed audits in Victoria for many years, for close to 10 years, and it shows that there are very few missed potential donors. So I think the healthcare sector is quite engaged and alert, but we are working to improve that.
So of the potential donors, how many of them just say outright no? Clearly quite a lot, I guess.
Yeah. Look, the consent rate for organ donation in this country sits around 50 and 60% of people who are potential donors. So it is quite low, and that's another area that the authority are looking at improving.
Let's talk about the basics of it, the mechanics. Now, which organs and which tissue? I didn't understand the whole tissue donation as well, so if you could explain that, that would be helpful.
It's not Kleenex, love.
Thank you. Well, now that clears it all up. Now, what can actually be donated and who can donate those? What are the circumstances around those donations?
Okay. So there are actually quite a lot of organs and tissues that are possible to be donated. So the common ones that we think of are heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, pancreas. In addition, there is an intestinal bowel program in Victoria. We've had recently the first hand transplant in Australia, so that's a first for us. And tissues, so eye tissue, skin and bone, and musculoskeletal, so tendons.
What happens to a person's body after the donations and the tissue has been? I have this terrible sense, yeah, that, you know, this, you know, well, I'll just take it all out and, yeah, off they go. It's sort of...
I think that's one of the common fears, Sue, that people think it's a disfiguring operation, where it really is not. It's possible to have a viewing, open casket, as any other deceased person. So the body actually retains its shape and appearance. So it's not disfiguring.
No one would know.
No.
Violet, gay men can't donate blood in this country. Laws have recently changed, sort of, in the UK. What about donating organs?
Yep.
Can gay men, actively sexual gay men, donate organs?
Absolutely. There's no exclusion for gay people donating organs. So it is different to blood. You're quite right. And I think...
And yet they all contain blood.
That's true.
Isn't that bizarre? Am I missing something?
No, it's a really good point. But I suppose you've got to look at a number of things. So every person living is a potential blood donor, and their screening process, I suppose, is a lot stricter. Whereas when you look at the low number of organ donors, you know, we try and be inclusive and only absolutely exclude someone if they do have a definite risk of transmitting a disease.
Right. So it's not a case of, you'll live with an HIV heart. rather than the heart you've got, that will be screened beforehand anyway.
Yes.
Right.
What about age limits?
Age limits are quite inclusive, so they've crept up over the years. So currently 75 to 80 years of age is the upper age limits
Would you feel a bit ripped off if you got a 75-year-old heart?
Not when you need a heart.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah.
What about the lower end of the scale, the younger kids? Well, I mean, we don't want to talk about kids dying, but unfortunately they do. Tell us about is there a bottom age limit?
Look, it's all... There's no absolute, I suppose, bottom age limit. A lot of organs are matched to size, so you'd need to ensure that there was a young child that needed with the suitable blood group and size match. So we would explore every opportunity for donation. And I just wanted to pick up, when you said about the 75-year-old heart, different organs have different age limits. So for heart, it's actually 60.
Okay.
Lungs are 65 and the other organs 75.
I understand the need for size matching because you wouldn't want a large male heart into a young 10-year-old female transplant. Like they wouldn't fit, for example.
Size matching is crucial. Sure. So blood group needs to be compatible. Size matching, particularly for some organs, so lungs and heart, livers can be cut down. So that's quite remarkable, or even split.
And then regrow with the body. Yeah.
It's really amazing.
What circumstances, we touched on it before, but what circumstances would a body have to be in for it to be an appropriate donor?
Okay.
Because there are circumstances of death that would make it possible for that body or that person to donate their organs.
True. So in this country, one of the reasons why there's so few organ donors is that less than 1% or 1% to 2% of people who die in hospital die in a way where they are able to donate organs. So most of our donors are patients who are declared brain dead. So they have irreversibly lost all function of their brain and they will not recover. So this is a particular scenario where their heart is able to continue beating for a period of time and there's a window opportunity for organ donation. However, there is also we're starting to look at donation after cardiac death, but this once again needs to occur in particular circumstances.
A lot of families are really cautious about coma, brain dead, and are they actually dead? How does that actually mechanically work at the time?
Yeah.
What processes are in place?
We live in a really good country for many different reasons, but we have a very good healthcare system and this is regulated very carefully. So there are particular tests that need to be performed that show that the brain has lost all function irreversibly. So it is different to a coma where some of the brain function has been damaged, but not all. So it's very different and there are strict tests and scans that need to be performed before organ donation would occur.
And timelines?
Timelines, look, it does need to occur in a sort of, it's not a mad rush or a huge urgency. It can be in some scenarios, but generally for the whole process of organ donation from the very start to the end of theatre, it's not uncommon to take 20 hours or so.
Last year, the end of last year, in December last year, there were over 1,200 people waiting for a kidney transplant and there were around 550 kidney transplants that were done last year. Of those waiting for a heart transplant, there were 88. And last year they did about 65 transplants. With lungs, there were 143 on the waiting list at the end of last year and 120 transplants were done. On average, people on the transplant list must wait somewhere between 6 months and 4 years. That's a lot of suffering. We're speaking with Violet Marion. She is the Organ Donor Coordinator for Donate Life Victoria. We'll be back with more after this. You're on Word for Word with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson.
Word for Word. Delve into the extraordinary lives of everyday people.
Word for Word. Challenging, inspiring, engaging and entertaining.
Word for Word with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson.
Broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network and supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, this is Word for Word. You're with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson and today we're talking about organ donor and transplant recipients.
Recipients. We've talked a little bit about the age of the recipient. We've talked about what happens to the body. We've talked about the difference between coma and brain dead. When families are faced with this time and they're not prepared, are you the person that goes and meets with them, or do you link other services? How does your job work?
Okay. So what happens generally, if a person has died in a way that they could donate, it would be the doctors and other medical staff, possibly nurses with the doctors, approaching the family to discuss, first of all, the prognosis of the person, that, you know, they've got an irrecoverable injury, and then looking at the option of organ donation as a possible option. If the family are open to that, that's where we would get called in, and we would then sit with the family and have a more detailed discussion around what happens next.
Now, one person who has received an organ transplant is Kate Driscoll. Now, she received a new liver in 2006 and joins us now on the phone. Kate, welcome.
Good morning, Dean.
Good morning. Kate, can you describe life for me prior to you getting your transplant, please?
Well, Dean, I was rather unwell. I wasn't as unwell as most people waiting for a liver transplant, and that's because of the nature of the illness that I had. I had this very impressive-sounding illness called hepatopulmonary disease, and it did mean that I was given about 6 months to live, and the only way that I could continue to live was with a liver transplant.
So on a donor registry, you were bumped to the top of the list.
Well, yes, I was, because what was happening was my supply of oxygen was diminishing, and so I was going bluer and bluer, and I needed, curiously, a new liver to improve my lung's capacity to breathe again.
Which is a little odd, but we'll take your word for it. What was life like after the transplant?
Life after the transplant for me was really, really quite interesting, because I had to spend 7 weeks at the Austin in Ward 7, because I had to then allow my lungs time to breathe again, and I had to let my liver improve. But it was quite different. I shifted from being in a state of concern about whether or not I was going to live, to a state of knowing, yes, that I was going to live.
And was there any sort of, were you hesitant in any way taking on board somebody else's bits?
Yes, initially I was. And when I was given the advice that I needed a liver transplant, I went home and talked to my partner, Liz. And my initial thinking was, well, no, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't have a transplant. And my concerns really weren't because I was taking on someone else's bits. It was more about a thinking of the value of my own life.
I believe your partner Liz is with us.
She is.
Liz, what did you think when Kate said, I don't want to have this done?
Oh, well, I guess I was a little bit shocked that here was an opportunity to grab life in fairly dire circumstances, and I was a bit surprised by Kate's response, but I felt this was an sort of a moral, ethical sort of issue that she personally needed to work through. You know, she's a recovering Catholic, so I think...
Oh, that's a bigger issue.
I think she was, you know, do I deserve this? When, you know, there's so many people who need a new organ to live, and Kate was questioning her own worthiness, I think.
Liz, like many life journeys, we never know where we're going to end up and what we see along the way. Were either of you registered as donors prior to this journey in Kate actually needing a donor?
I certainly was, because Kate got sick in about 1998, I think, first up, and I was on the organ donor list.
How did that affected you? Do you think, wow, this is really odd that now I'm actually going to be a partner's recipient of a program that I advocated?
Oh, I think it's a fantastic thing that that people have the opportunity to, you know, they might not be around, but the opportunity to give somebody else the chance of a new life or a new start to life is very precious.
Does it give you a new outlook on life?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How have things changed for you both?
Well, Kate's healthy and well, probably in our relationship of some 14 years, you know, about 7 years of it, she's been sick. And so the last 5 years have been a healthy life.
What about the medical process for you? How daunting was that?
Very. I remember Kate at one point had to go on a drug trial, and they said that it's going to, you know, impact on her behaviour, and you know, we did have some moments that we called Linda Blair moments where her head spun around and
great for dinner parties.
Yeah, and I did wonder whether you know, whether she was going to be the same person, because her personality seemed quite changed through the drugs that she was on, and you know, it's. People used to say to me, well, how are you coping? And it's like, well, I don't think you think about it. You just take up each day as it presents itself to you.
Kate, you lived with this for 7 or 8 years prior to your transplant. Your ability to do things then as compared to now must be greatly different.
Yes, it is.
Was it lung capacity that was being compromised?
Yes, it was lung capacity. That didn't exist for that entire 7 years. That was probably particularly in the 6 months prior to the transplant.
Funny how I still think it's odd that a new liver gives you the ability to breathe. But
well, I guess, Dean, one of the things about being involved with the medical profession is the extraordinary capacity of medical interventions, and I guess for me that was an extraordinary insight that. The capacity to actually take a living organ from one person and give it to another person and give that person life is an extraordinary leap of faith. And yet, certainly the transplant team at the Austin perform that on a regular basis and transform people's lives from near death to be able to lead productive, happy, useful lives. And, you know, that's an amazing success story.
It certainly is. Liz made reference, Kate, to your not feeling worthy. What changed in you to then accept this as an option?
I think Liz's love, having someone who cares deeply about you really gives you a sense of meaning in life. And, you know, if you have a partner, I have a very supportive family who've certainly been very accepting of my same-sex status. My workplace, I work at RMIT, so I had an organisation that was, and colleagues who were very supportive. So I think all of those things, if you have them behind you, they help you to see that, yeah, you know, live. And seize the opportunity that's presented to you.
Kate, along with the psychological issues that go along with organ donation and being a recipient, what about the lifelong use of medication for you? Are you now on regular medication to maintain?
Yes, I am. And, you know, I guess with every good medical intervention, you know, there are a set of complications. Yes, you have to take a lifelong regime of anti-rejection drugs. Although in my case, my transplant was relatively straightforward, you do have some ongoing health issues. I've currently got very high blood pressure, you know, and so you just learn to manage those sorts of things. And I guess in the overall scheme of life, they are relatively minor issues.
But if I could intervene, you know, I remember I used to call her my little maraca, because when Kate first was discharged from hospital, the pills that she needed to take on a daily basis, like, was a minor meal in itself. And so, I don't know, there would have been 8 or 10 different types of pills that she was popping. And now she's down to one, which is the anti-rejection drug, and then she's got a couple of other little health issues that have popped up, you know, low magnesium, so they have to have magnesium pills, and now these blood pressure pills. But compared to what she was on, you know, it's extraordinary. The dosage has dropped significantly to the absolute minimum level that she can take.
The liver is the largest and heaviest organ in the body with over 500 functions. It removes toxins from the blood, processes food nutrients, it acts as a food storage and distribution centre, and it helps regulate the body's metabolism. In Australia in 2008, 179 donors enabled 195 liver transplants to take place. In certain situations, donated livers can be split and given to two recipients, and children often receive a split liver. Kate Driscoll was one of those recipients in 2006, and it enabled her to breathe again. You're with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson across Australia in the Community Radio Network. We'll be back with more after this.
Word for Word, delve into the extraordinary lives of everyday people.
Word for Word, challenging, inspiring, engaging and entertaining.
Word for Word with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson.
Broadcast live on Joy 94.9, Sundays from 11 a.m. and supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
Welcome to Word for Word across Australia on your community radio network. Today we are talking all about the donation of life and organ donation. Now the website, if you are interested, is donatelife.gov.au.
If you donate your heart, the tissue from that can help between 8 and 10 people. Now, of course, the heart's main function is to pump some 4 to 5 litres of blood around the body every minute, beating some 70 to 80 times when resting, and of course faster when exercising. Trudy Rundle was a recipient of a heart transplant in 2004. She joins us now on the phone. Trudy, welcome, Word for Word.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Trudy, your heart transplant must have really given you a new lease on life. How did you feel once you had recovered from your operation?
$1 million. Yeah, it really was. Getting my heart was a little bit of a surprise. I've got lupus, which is an autoimmune disease, and the virus attacked my heart, so cardiomyopathy, and I was in hospital for about in ICU for nearly a month, and I went to the top of the list for a new heart and was lucky enough to receive one. So it was a bit of a shock to me, quite healthy with the disease, lupus, and then all of a sudden getting a new heart. So did
the intervention occur before your heart fully collapsed, I guess? You were rushed to the top of the list, but they saw what was coming?
I guess when I went into ICU, they started with my left ventricle had collapsed, so they put me on a balloon pump to help try and recover the heart. And then I went on a heart-lung machine for nearly 3 weeks, and then it got so severe that I had to get a new heart. So they sort of knew that it was going to happen, but they were trying to get my heart to work, I guess.
Just prior to the operation, when you were told that they had found a suitable donor, how did that make you feel?
Quite relieved, because I didn't feel I was going anywhere. I was in and out of operations, and I couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel, really. So, yeah, relieved to get a new heart.
Trudy, how did this mess with you psychologically?
I suffered from post-traumatic stress afterwards for quite some time, and I still think, you know, driving in a car, I can get quite nervous at times. So, yeah, it had a real impact in that way.
Trudy, tell us a bit more about that.
I guess when I was actually in Sydney when I got my heart at St Vincent's up there, all the staff were fabulous, and I had family tag team and come up and stay with me, but when the last person left, I was sat on the 14th floor of my apartment, and I just felt like someone was going to jump on the balcony and come in with a knife and stab me. So it was quite unrealistic what was going to happen, but I just had those sort of feelings for quite some time.
Very challenging.
Yeah, it was a bit, but worked through it with friends and family. So,
Trudy, when you yourself experience that and you're the recipient, does it give you some empathy with the families who are the donors?
Oh, Oh, without a doubt. I always thought I received a young male's heart for some reason, and I was able to write a letter after I had my transplant just to say thank you for this wonderful gift. But I never received any reply, and I guess they would be struggling with their loss while I've got the gain of life. They've lost someone that they love, so...
Indeed. Tell me why you think you received a young male heart.
I'm not sure. Just nothing. I don't think I changed physically. I didn't start to grow a moustache or anything like that, but I just had this feeling. I don't know. Funnily enough, in 2004, if you may remember, David Hooks died in January that year.
Indeed.
And donations were raised by about 33% that year. And I always thought because of that, he was on a male radio station, 3AW, so whether that had some bearing on it. But, yeah, I don't know, just a feeling, I guess.
Trudy, the heart is said to have neurons like our brain does, and there is some theories going around that those neurons, when placed into a recipient, connect with the host's brain and take on board characteristics or certain things that the host didn't have prior to the heart transplant. Are there any stories like that from you?
Unfortunately, I can't really...
Do you drink beer now and never drank beer before or something?
No, I used to drink beer, so that hasn't
changed.
Oh, okay. Probably more red wine now. I do like a steak. I love AFL. So, yeah, it's a little bit hard for me to distinguish whether this, if it was a male heart.
So if you see Trudy kicking a footy around, you'll know what's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Trudy, you touched on it briefly about connecting with the families and the importance of you to write a letter of thank you. Do you think that's something that needs perhaps a little bit more work on whatever way that does take shape and form, but that need for a recipient to make some sort of a connection, to have some sort of closure or growth with this process?
At the start I did. I was really... it was all about getting this heart and getting a new life, and I really did want to connect with the host family, but understood they would be grieving. But as the times wore on, I am still eternally grateful, but it hasn't got the same feelings for me that I need to connect with them. So I guess just in the aftermath of getting your new organ and new life, it probably might be important to connect at that stage.
Violet, as an organ donor coordinator, do you see this as an area of growth that families may want to later on say, I just want to check in, I just want to find out some information, I want to know that what we did and that decision that we made as a family has paid off?
I know personally that there are many donor families who benefit from hearing back from the recipients, and that's done confidentially through a letter, usually, that's sent through the transplant unit and through us. We have many, many families. I mean, people are very individual, and some people, because of their grief or because of who they are, don't feel that they can know much about the recipients because it just hurts too much. But there are, I'd say, overwhelmingly more people who benefit from hearing from the recipient.
Are there networks or their processes in place so that these families can do these connections?
There are established processes. So generally, donor families and recipients can write to each other and pass the correspondence through us and the transplant hospital. Other than that, there's support groups and different things on the web, but there's nothing, I mean, organ donation in this country is a confidential process, so legally we're not allowed to disclose the identity.
And it's a free process. We're
yes.
not allowed to sell them
That's
organs
right.
as well.
That's correct.
Unlike some countries. Trudy Rundle, your new heart you received some 7 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been given an expectancy of how long it should keep pumping away for you?
I'm hoping for years and years. I was lucky enough to meet Fiona Coote, and, you know, she's had the two transplants and over 20 years with her new heart. So I'm expecting to be around about another 40 years, especially if I've received a young heart.
Indeed.
So the body might fail, but I think the heart will keep pumping.
Does it mean a life of medication, though, that you have to keep taking to...?
Yeah, I do take a lot of medication, but I've been working full-time for... I took about 2 or 3 months to recover, and I've been working full time ever since. So
that's pretty good.
Yeah, I've kept myself quite fit, so I like to just live a normal life.
Trudy, being so unwell, you wouldn't have been able to work. Were there necessary supports that you could put into place so that you could maintain a home or a balance of, you know, having whatever you needed when you needed it?
I've always worked.
You didn't stop working throughout this process?
No, I've always been working. So I had a couple of months in hospital, and then I think it was about a month and a half, and then I started back part-time, which is about 4 days. But I've always supported myself.
You're a tough chick.
I am a bit. Yeah, it's been important to me to keep going. And
I asked Kate whether she was on the registry, her and Liz, whether they were on prior to, I guess, feeling or knowing that you were on the way to being a recipient. Were you actually on the registry prior?
Yes, I have been for quite some time.
And how was that mentally for you, going, hang on, I'm on the other side of that now?
Grateful, very happy, and I was always prepared to give an organ, so, you know, I didn't feel that bad that I was in need of one.
From your experience, what would you like to tell people? How can you say it's not, you know, please do this?
Well, you know, I wouldn't be here, so I just can't thank the donors enough. And I think it's been touched on before that you might need them at some stage, but there's other people that will, so it's just the best gift that anyone can give.
Certainly is. Trudy Rundle, thank you very much for joining us on Word for Word today. We really appreciate your insights in regards to your new heart.
Great, thank you.
That's Trudy Rundle, heart recipient in 2004. Of course, we are talking about organ donor, and donatelife.gov.au is the website that you can log on to register.
Now, I checked it out. It seems very easy. It looks a little bit like you have to go and get a passport, but it's only a quick process, isn't it, to do it. So what would you have to do? What information do we need to put there?
Basic information. The organ donor register is held by the Medicare Australia under the same sort of system, so not dissimilar, you know, name, address, your wishes.
But the major thing that we touched on at first was that
I had my driver's licence years ago that I put it on, but that's no longer relevant.
That's right.
So explain that for us.
So it's been the driver's licence indication for organ donation has been phased out in every state in Australia. The only place it still is operational is New South Wales. And there is a move, and there has been a move to a centralised registry, which is this system that we've got now through the website.
And the extraordinary work that the new government authority has done, it's managed to achieve quite a benchmark in a very small space of time.
It is. It's really, I mean, I've been working in this area for 8 years now, and it's quite exciting to see what can happen when the right resources.
Were you hesitant in the lead up to this sort of federal authority taking over what was a state-based issue?
Not really.
No?
No. I think, look, people who have worked in this area have recognised that, you know, we need to actually consolidate and use our resources together instead of every state doing its own thing. Let's work together.
And in fact, we share with New Zealand. We send bits over there too.
That's true. Yeah. That is true. Yeah. And they send organs over. So there is a relationship there.
The word bits, Dean.
Well, I know. Well, there's so many bits
there
that can
so
be.
There are so many. Now, what a...
They've got to be put on ice, love. Go
on. I know. Talking about donation, and if you're on the register, I've done all the work, I'm on the register, but unfortunately something's happened, I'm in the situation where my family makes that decision, that can be overridden unless I've had a conversation.
Look, most times, to be honest, in my experience, most times where families know that their loved one wanted to be a donor, whether that is through the register or having had a conversation, it's very rare that they'll override that wish. And it's usually exceptional circumstances that, you know, people would understand. But the main thing is that we keep saying, have that conversation with your family so they know. I mean, these families are going through such an awful time. It's often a sudden death. It can be quite traumatic circumstances. And I personally feel for them so much. And I feel quite awkward at times sort of stepping into that space in their lives. But they're extraordinary people who can have the capacity to think of other people that their worst time in their life. And I think, you know, having met with so many families over the years, families who know what their loved one wanted, that decision for organ donation is so much easier. Whether it's a yes or a no, at least they know they are complying with what you wanted.
And it starts with that family conversation, doesn't
it? It does.
There are other ways that you can register as well, apart from the website. You can call 1-800-777-203. That's 1-800-777-203. Or you can fill out a form at any Medicare office, and your local GP may have forms as well in regards to being an organ and tissue donor.
And the website again is donatelife.gov.au.
We have been speaking today with Violet Marion, Organ Donor Coordinator for Donate Life Victoria. We also spoke to Trudy Rundle, who received a heart in 2004, and Kate Driscoll, who received a liver in 2006, along with her partner Liz, joined us as well. I'd like to round it up by giving you this quote, if I may, from Her Excellency, Ms. Quinton Bryce, the Governor-General of the Commonwealth of Australia, and in her inaugural speech regarding Donate Life and as the ambassador for Donate Life, she said, "We are forever indebted to those Australians who have chosen to give life. They have made their mark in the most profound ways, leaving their courageous stamp."
Beautiful.
Violet Marion, thank you very much for joining us Word for Word today. It's been a really worthwhile conversation to have, and I hope all of our listeners engage with their families to, together as a family unit, make this happen.
I'm heading off to the computer right now to put my new stamp on to update my registration.
Thank you very much for listening and joining us today on Word for Word. I'm Dean Beck.
And I'm Sue Wilkinson.
You'll find a podcast and a transcript of this interview available for download from Joy's website. Until next time, take care and bye for now.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Briley and presented by Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9. Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation and is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network.
Service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.